down on his flagship, again. His protective flight of Zeros was ineffective, again. The howls got louder and louder as the SPDs plunged down. The Shokaku's skipper, Captain Arima Masafumi, threw the carrier into a hard right turn. One 500-pound bomb hit just 10 meters off the starboard side, killing six. The second splashed another 10 meters beyond the first. Physical damage was negligible. That was far too close for Admiral Nagumo. His carrier scrambled more Zeros, four from the Zuikaku and the last 11 aboard the Shokaku. Nagumo also ordered Admiral Abe and the Vanguard Force to close on the American carriers and destroy them in surface action that night. Lieutenant Davis and Ensign Shaw headed back, making contact and attack reports. Davis was very careful to give his identification, the Japanese carrier's position, course, and speed. Not that it mattered much. Radio reception on this day was not ideal, so much so that on his way back to Indani, Lieutenant Kellum felt obliged to detour his PBY to the Enterprise and flash his earlier contact report, and also a new report of 3 light cruisers, 2 destroyers, and 3 transports 50 miles from his first contact. As for Davis and Shaw's report, the only thing that got through to the Enterprise in Saratoga was 2 carriers with decks full. This wasn't much use unless, like Admiral Nagumo, one had enough information to deduce their position. A report of 2 carriers with decks full was disturbing enough, but it was nothing compared to what showed up on the Enterprise's CXAM radar at 4:02, a large contact, bearing 320 degrees true, northwest, distance 88 miles. The Saratoga, about 10 miles from the Enterprise, picked it up too, at a range of 103 miles. The contact faded, but no one believed it was a phantom. It was a Japanese airstrike. Admiral Fletcher's worst nightmare had been realized. His carriers were about to be attacked, with no idea of where the Japanese carriers were, and with his own airstrike already committed. Admiral Fletcher had to send up additional fighters, but launching planes off an aircraft carrier is not easy. At that moment, the Saratoga was some 140 miles east of Malaita, heading northwest at a speed of 20 knots. The Enterprise was about 10 miles off her port quarter. To create enough headwind to generate enough lift for aircraft to take off from their short flight decks, both carriers had to turn into the wind, which was from the southeast, as it almost always was in this area, and speed up. So both forces turned to the southeast and rang up 25 knots, driving the carriers and their escorts into long, heavy swells, with destroyers bouncing almost out of the water. The Enterprise immediately launched her remaining fighters and vectored 10 already aloft northwest toward the contact, hoping to catch them well short of the carriers. At the same time, another Japanese float plane, this one from the battleship Hiei, helpfully provided updated location information on the U.S. carriers to the Japanese. Not as helpfully, the information the float plane provided had the American flat tops 50 miles further south than they actually were and headed southeast instead of northwest. Lieutenant Commander Seiki adjusted his course slightly more toward the south, hoping to chase them down. 2 minutes later, the Enterprise CXAM radar detected another, smaller contact. Now she turned those 10 Wildcats more toward the west and the new contact. She also vectored another group of 4 fighters toward the northwest, followed by another group of 16 Fighting Six fighters that had just launched. Now 3 groups of fighters were fanning out to the northwest in 3 different vectors, leaving no fighters over the Enterprise. Fletcher ordered Admiral Kincaid to close the Enterprise force on the Saratoga and launch his currently spotted small attack force so the Japanese attack would not catch the Enterprise with flammable aircraft on deck. The Saratoga cleared her own deck of aircraft, 2 Dauntlesses, 5 Avengers, and 6 Wildcats. Both groups were ordered to join up, head north, and attack anything Japanese they found, preferably that carrier reported by Lieutenant Commander Jet, that is, the Ryujo. When Lieutenant Harold H. Swede Larson, head of the reconstituted Torpedo 8, heard they were going to attack something instead of just making time beyond range of the Japanese attack, he came out and bodily threw a pilot out of an Avenger to take it over himself. The Enterprise fighters aloft managed to isolate that new small bogey. It was a returning Avenger scout. With that mystery solved, at 4:18, the large inbound contact appeared, now only 44 miles away on a bearing of 320 degrees true, northwest. Its altitude was estimated to be 12,000 feet. Four Saratoga fighters had to land to refuel, quickly, hopefully, but Admiral Fletcher still had 11 Wildcats 40 miles to the northwest, with another 16 en route, now ordered to move up to 12,000 feet. Closer to the carriers themselves were 15 more. Seven were to escort the Enterprise airstrike and could be redirected. All in all, 53 fighters were waiting for the Japanese attack, but not necessarily in the right place. The Enterprise and her escorts, in a ring formation, came into Lieutenant Commander Seki's view at 4:20. With the carrier still 40 miles away and off to his left, Seki had the attack group turn toward the east in order to attack from the north. As he had his Sea Eagles head east, Seki saw another carrier, the Saratoga, beyond the Enterprise to the southeast. And as he had his Sea Eagles head east, Seki unintentionally outwitted the Enterprise's fighter director officer, Lieutenant Commander Leonard J. Ham Dow, who, seeing Seki's earlier turn toward the south, had concluded that the Japanese would attack from the west, and so had directed 11 Wildcats in that direction. Seki passed them, headed in the opposite direction. Lieutenant Commander Seki's observer, Special Duty Ensign Nakasada Jiro, sent out the message, "Assume attack formation." Lieutenant Shigematsu's four remaining Zeros moved out in front to carry out their mission, which was technically called air control. How these four Zeros planned to control 53 enemy fighters has never been satisfactorily explained. But the Japanese air control was made so much easier when 11 of the Enterprise's Wildcats had been sent too far west and missed the inbound Japanese entirely. Worse, the defending Grummans were too low. The Japanese were at 18,000 feet, the defenders at 12,000 to 15,000 feet. Four Wildcats under Lieutenant Vorse tried desperately to climb and hack away at the valves, but Lieutenant Shigematsu's Zeros ripped through them. With the Japanese now at 27 miles and closing, the Enterprise finally launched her airstrike. 11 Dauntlesses under Lieutenant Caldwell and 7 Avengers under Lieutenant Reuben H. Koenig, all commanded by Air Group Skipper Lieutenant Commander Maxwell F. Leslie, a hero of the Battle of Midway. They were told to head north, attack anything they could find, and land on Guadalcanal if they had to. The 7 Wildcats, originally slated to escort them, were pulled off the strike, but since they had been part of it, their radios were tuned to the strike frequency and not the fighter director frequency. They were told to orbit the Enterprise at 15,000 feet and keep an eye out for incoming Japanese. As the wheels of Lieutenant Commander Leslie's Command TBF Avenger bounced off the Enterprise's flight deck at 4:38, Seki's radio operator, Ensign Nakasada, sent another message, "All forces, attack." Lieutenant Osuka's 9 Zuikaku Type 99 carrier bombers made for the Saratoga, while the Shokaku Type 99s were lined up in a column on the Enterprise's port quarter as the carrier turned away to starboard toward a course 170 degrees true, south-southeast. It was time for the Sea Eagles of Kido Butai to avenge Midway. Only now did the defending U.S. Navy fighters realize that all was not sunny above them. Lieutenant Hitaka's 6 Zeros from the Zuikaku momentarily pulled away from Lieutenant Commander Seki's bombers to ambush a flight of 3 Wildcats from the Saratoga, commanded by Fighting Five Flight Officer Lieutenant David C. Richardson. The flight was scattered, and one Wildcat, piloted by veteran Lieutenant Marion W. Duffalo, vanished. Two more Wildcats from the Saratoga tried to intervene and were driven off. More fighters from the Saratoga headed northwest toward the threatened Enterprise, but they were all too low, for now. "The enemy planes are now directly overhead," reported the Enterprise's radar plot in desperation. But the lookouts could not see the enemy planes in the sun. To make matters worse, the fighter director officer, Lieutenant Commander Dow, was struggling to position the defending fighters because both his communications and communications among the fighters shared the same radio frequency, and many of the younger fighters were talking too much. Dow tried desperately to break into the fighter frequency. Starting at 4:41, one by one, the Aichi Type 99s pushed over into their dives on the Enterprise, whose fire control radar just went out. The carrier's gunners struggled, looking into the sun to pick out the attackers. It was a puff of smoke from above the port bow that caught the attention of Marine First Sergeant Joseph R. Shinka, commanding a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft battery on the carrier's port side. With the target still out of range, Shinka opened fire, not to hit the target, but to attract attention, for the Enterprise was not alone. The Enterprise was in the center of, as Lieutenant Commander Seki had described it, a ring formation with a radius of 1,800 to 2,000 yards. The ring included six destroyers, Belch, Maury, Ellet, Monson, Grayson, and Benham, but off the Enterprise's port bow was the heavy cruiser Portland. Off the starboard bow was the light anti-aircraft cruiser Atlanta, with 16 5-inch dual-purpose guns in eight twin mounts, and astern was the brand-new post-Pearl Harbor battleship North Carolina. Though aircraft carriers were supplanting battleships as the queens of the seas, battleships were still vital. The North Carolina was the first modern U.S. Navy battleship completed since World War I, the first of a new class, indeed a new generation, of American battleships. With all of the Pacific Fleet's battleships disabled, in the humiliating disaster of December 7th, the arrival of the new North Carolina at Pearl Harbor in July was inspiring for the hard-pressed sailors on hand, even for Admiral Nimitz himself. I well remember the great thrill when she arrived in Pearl Harbor during the early stages of the war, at a time when our strength and fortunes were at low ebb. She was the first of the great new battleships to join the Pacific Fleet, and her mere presence in a task force was enough to keep morale at a peak. The presence of the North Carolina did not go unnoticed on the Enterprise, nor did the presence of the battleship's massive anti-aircraft battery of 25-inch dual-purpose guns in 10 twin mounts and 15 1.1-inch guns. Lieutenant Commander Seki led his dive bombers down, pushing over at precise intervals of 7 seconds, like a long, long train going over the top of the big hill of a roller coaster, gaining speed, plunging, screaming downward. But Seki's dive bombers had gained four planes diving with them, a flight of four Grummans under Lieutenant Richard E. Chick Harmer from the Saratoga. Too late to prevent the dives, his angry Wildcats joined the dives instead, snarling and slashing at the Vals as the Sea Eagles tried to stay on target. Harmer and his pilots did not have to shoot the Vals down, they just had to disrupt their attack. Lieutenant Commander Seki himself was harassed and harangued by Lieutenant Harmer's wingman, Ensign John MacDonald, driving the Japanese Air Group commander to miss with his bomb. Harmer himself drove the second Val, that of Petty Officer First Class Imada Tetsu, to distraction, and a miss with its bomb. Lieutenant Howard Cruz ripped into the third Val, that of Petty Officer First Class Sasaki Mitsuo, but had to pull away before he could see what happened to the Japanese. Sasaki's pilot, Seaman First Class Akutagawa Takeshi, released his bomb too early, and it splashed some 200 yards off the Enterprise's port quarter. Sasaki's Val caught fire, then spun into the water 600 yards off the carrier's port beam. The fourth member of Harmer's flight, Ensign Benjamin Mole Curry, was forced into a twisting dive that prevented him from taking any shots. Lieutenant Cruz had to pull up because the anti-aircraft fire from the U.S. Navy ships was becoming too intense for him to risk being a victim of friendly fire. The normally dry narrative from the Office of Naval Intelligence opined, "The volume of our anti-aircraft fire was tremendous." The fiercest came from the North Carolina. Ensign Fred Mears, heading out in one of the Enterprise's Avengers, was stunned when the North Carolina opened up with her anti-aircraft battery. The battleship accompanying our carrier lit up like a Christmas tree. On the Enterprise, Admiral Kincaid could not believe what he was seeing from the North Carolina and had the carrier signal her, "Are you afire?" The next six Vals pushed over into their dives with little in the way of fighter opposition, but seemed to be having difficulty with the unexpectedly heavy anti-aircraft fire. The eighth and ninth Vals of Seki's group were those of Petty Officer First Class Yasuda Nobuyoshi and Petty Officer Second Class Kitamura Kenzo. Diving into a nightmare of shell bursts, Yasuda's Val was torched, forcing his pilot, Petty Officer Second Class Shirai Goro, to release his bomb too high. The bomb splashed into the water off the Enterprise's starboard bow, the flaming Aichi following right behind it. Kitamura had anti-aircraft fire coming from the front and machine gun fire from the Enterprise Wildcat of gunsmith Brewer behind him. Brewer had to pull up because of the friendly flak, but by then the Val was doomed. Fatally damaged and flaming like a comet, the Aichi plummeted downward into the blizzard of burning lead as pilot Petty Officer Second Class Miki Isamu released his bomb too high, again, and aimed the burning, barely under control dive bomber for the Enterprise's flight deck. His bomb missed to starboard, while his Type 99 screamed past sky control in a fiery blur and plunged into the water to port. The first 9 valves of Seiki's attack had missed with their bombs. The last 9, led by Lieutenant Arima Keiichi, had an additional handicap of being clawed by 4 Enterprise Wildcats under machinist Barnes, who had been directed too far west to intercept the Japanese on the inbound and had to chase them from behind to catch them as they pushed over. Barnes shouted, "Okay, let's go give them hell." 1 Val immediately went down to Barnes' wingman, Ensign Robert A.M. Ram, Dib, but Barnes himself took the full force of a 5-inch anti-aircraft burst that blew the wings and tail off his fighter, sending them both to their doom, some 2,000 yards off the port quarter of the destroyer Bulge. Lieutenant Arima pushed over to lead his Aichis in the dive into a hellstorm of flak, far more intense than anything he had ever seen in his years of service in China. Arima watched in horror as the Type 99s of Petty Officers Yasuda and Kitamura were set alight in front of him. But his pilot, Petty Officer First Class Furata Kyoto, grimly held their dive and released their 551-pound bomb. Furata pulled out very low, and Arima watched the bomb burrow through the flight deck's number 3 elevator to explode at 4:44 in the chief's quarters on the third deck. About half a minute after, and 20 feet away from Lieutenant Arima's bomb hit, came another bomb. This from the Type 99 of Petty Officer First Class Koitabashi Hiroshi, flown by Petty Officer First Class Akimoto Tamotsu. This bomb detonated in the number 3 5-inch gun gallery, disabling both guns, setting off ready powder, threatening the 5-inch magazines, and killing all 38 men operating the guns. Following Petty Officer Koitabashi was Petty Officer Second Class Iida Yoshihiro. His own bomb was set afire by 20mm rounds from the Enterprise's guns. While the whole idea of a bomb involves setting it on fire to quickly explode, it is considered preferable that it do so after it has hit the target, or at least after it has left the plane. Iida's Val disintegrated in a tremendous burst in midair, and nothing but small pieces came fluttering down, just like confetti on Wall Street. 3 more Type 99s, those of Lieutenant J.G., Motoyama Hiroyuki, Petty Officer Second Class Chuchiya Ryoroku, and Petty Officer Second Class Horie Kazumi, pushed over to attack the Enterprise. Motoyama and Tsuchiya, between them, managed only a near miss to starboard. Horie's Aichi, pounded by gunfire, began to break apart during his dive, but he released his bomb at an altitude of about 1,500 feet to hit the Enterprise's flight deck just aft of the number 2 center elevator, disabling the elevator and leaving only the forward elevator operable, blasting a 10-foot hole in the flight deck and damaging some of the arresting gear. But these were the last attacks on the Enterprise. The last 3 Aichis, under Warrant Officer Argane Masaki, for reasons known only to him, did not attack the Enterprise, but instead went astern of the carrier to attack the North Carolina. All 3 were shot down after dropping their bombs, their sacrifices netting only 3 near misses. That left Lieutenant Otsuka's 9 Zuikaku Type 99 carrier bombers to fight their way to the Saratoga, and fight they would have to, because the American fighters were now swarming. The first to challenge Otsuka and his Vals were 3 Saratoga Grummans under Lieutenant Hayden Jensen. Otsuka was trying to form his Type 99s into a column for the dive on the Saratoga, but that just left Jensen and his pilots to stalk them from astern. Jensen was quickly joined by 4 Enterprise Wildcats under machinist Don Runyon. More Wildcats appeared ahead. Otsuka decided he would not make it to the Saratoga and opted to turn back toward the Enterprise. He turned just in time for his close air cover, 4 Zeros from the Zuikaku, to join in what became a wild air melee. It was also just in time for Lieutenant Otsuka to be shot down, by whom is unknown. Leaderless, the remaining 7 Vals scattered to different targets. 4 bombed the North Carolina, netting 4 misses, with all 4 shot down. 3 gained up an Enterprise, losing one of their own without a hit. Even so, some of the Enterprise were highly impressed with the work of Lieutenant Commander Seiki's men. Captain Arthur C. Davis described the dives as steep, estimated at 70 degrees, well-executed, and absolutely determined. Senior Landing Signal Officer Lieutenant Robin Lindsay was more effusive. These Jap planes launched about the most beautiful, awe-inspiring attack I have ever seen. It was almost suicidal, in fact, they came so low. They used a rollover approach, a rather shallow dive, about 60 to 55 degrees, came down and released about 1,000 feet, and were pulling out at 200 feet. But beauty is indeed in the eye of the beholder. The gunnery officer of the cruiser Portland, Lieutenant Commander Elliot Shanklin, who had seen 5 other Japanese dive-bombing attacks, was less impressed. He found their technique wanting, as pushing over in a line one at a time left each one's view of the target obscured by the plane ahead. Moreover, Shanklin saw some of the Vels veer from their dive rather than continue. Many released early at high altitudes. Others appeared deflected to a considerable extent from the course of their dives by the heavy anti-aircraft fire, which left them with both the physical and the psychological handicap imposed by the barrage. In short, while the attacks were good, Shanklin had seen better. It is for very good reasons that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable form of evidence. But there were other attackers about who might be better. At 4:51 p.m., the Enterprise's radar showed a large contact, 50 miles away, bearing 265 degrees true, almost due west, heading southwest. This was Admiral Nagumo's follow-up strike, launched a little before 4 p.m., and led by Lieutenant Takahashi Sadamu, head of the Zuikaku's air group. It consisted of 18 Type 99s from the Zuikaku and 9 from the Shokaku, under Lieutenant Yamada Shohei, escorted by 6 Zeros from the Zuikaku and 3 from the Shokaku, under Lieutenant Shirane Ayao, who headed the Zuikaku's fighter group. On board the Enterprise, anxious eyes watched the radar. The carrier was still burning, still could not handle aircraft. Everyone had to go to the Saratoga for the moment. Though her damage was not serious, the Enterprise herself was currently helpless. But Lieutenant Takahashi's strike was going the wrong way. Another search plane from the Chikuma had the Enterprise in sight, had watched the decimation of Lieutenant Commander Seiki's strike, and had radioed the carrier's position. Takahashi didn't pick up that message. That contact report was rebroadcast by Kido Butai. Takahashi didn't pick that up either. At 5:30, Lieutenant Commander Seiki radioed his report of the results of his strike and the position of the American carriers. Takahashi missed that one, too. Some of his pilots had copied the messages, but no one thought to tell him. So Lieutenant Takahashi led his strike over empty water, more than 80 miles south of the Enterprise. Then he turned to search to the west, getting further and further away from his quarry. The damage control on the Enterprise was very efficient. At 5:40, Admiral Kincaid reported to Admiral Fletcher that the carrier had suffered 2 bomb hits and some underwater damage, but said damage was apparently light. Less than 10 minutes later, the Enterprise was conducting flight operations, landing 33 planes in the next 21 minutes. At 6:10, she stopped for a bit to spot and launch 5 Wildcats for combat air patrol. The radar guys and fighter director started breathing a little easier as Lieutenant Takahashi's strike moved off. Things were looking up. But nothing looks up for very long around Guadalcanal. It's as if the island's fundamental dishonesty infects everything around it. Pandemonium. The first bomb hit on the Enterprise blew off a ventilating trunk line, allowing smoke from the fire caused by the second bomb hit into the steering compartment. The 7-man crew in the compartment shut off the ventilation system and covered the vent, but eventually, temperatures in the confined compartment reached 170 degrees, requiring the vent to be reopened. Water and fomite, as well as smoke and fumes, flooded the compartment through the open vent. The steering engine shorted out, and before the crew could switch to the reserve engine, they were overcome by smoke. The upshot was that without warning, the Enterprise's rudder jammed 20 degrees to starboard. The carrier plowed through her protective screen like the proverbial bull in a china shop chasing its own tail. Her siren sounded to warn the ships around her. Destroyer Balch had to scurry out of the way to narrowly avoid being run down, as the Enterprise's Captain Davis frantically rang all stop. Davis tried to regain control by steering the carrier with her engines, but they could not overcome the torque of the rudder. He brought the carrier to 10 knots, so she would be steaming in smaller circles. But the Enterprise was now helpless, with Lieutenant Takahashi's airstrike still on the hunt for her. Admiral Fletcher signaled that the Enterprise might need a tug, though how the torque of the rudder could be overcome with a tow is anybody's guess. Carrier Saratoga took over providing air cover for the beleaguered flat top. During this time, she managed to land her strike that had brought Ryujo to grief. The Enterprise's damage control was working feverishly to restore helm control. Everyone kept calm and let Chief Machinist William A. Smith handle it. He donned breathing gear and went to hack his way into the smoke and fumes of the steering compartment. Twice he was overcome and pulled back by a safety line, but on the third try, Smith got in and switched the rudder over to the standby motor. Helm control was restored at 6:58, exactly 38 minutes after the rudder had jammed. In the words of Morrison, that's the kind of thing that wins battles, no less than good shooting and accurate bombing. There would be no more good shooting or accurate bombing from the Japanese this day. Lieutenant Takahashi's strike was forced to return to Kidobutai and land after dark, the carriers turning on their searchlights to guide the Sea Eagles back, meeting only limited success. The strikes launched in desperation by the Enterprise in Saratoga met with a bit more success, not against the Japanese carriers, which they never found, but against Admiral Kondo's advance force. Lieutenant Larson led five Avengers of Torpedo 8, boring in from port against Kondo's cruisers, claiming one hit, but in reality getting none. However, on the way back, one Grumman, piloted by Lieutenant J.G. Edward Frenchy Fail, was jumped by two Zeros from the Shokaku, flown by Petty Officer First Class Iwaki Yoshio and Petty Officer Second Class Ohara Hiroshi. Together, they perforated the Avenger's right wing and fuselage and shattered the plexiglass of the turret. But the Sea Eagles continued to wither away as Iwaki, a Japanese ace who had gunned down members of Torpedo 8 at Midway, was killed by Fail's gunner, aviation radio man Petty Officer Third Class Edward Velasquez. Fail would have to ditch short of Guadalcanal, but would be recovered August 29th. Two more Saratoga aircraft, Dauntlesses flown by Lieutenant J.G. Robert M. Elder and Ensign Robert T. Gordon, got their own shot at Admiral Kondo's advance force. They only glimpsed Kondo's surface warships in passing over them to target the seaplane tender Chitose, who was stopped recovering her floatplanes after a long day of sparring with Catalina flying boats. Diving from 12,500 feet, Elder and Gordon got at least one near miss with a 1,000-pound bomb portside aft. Three floatplanes were set afire. More seriously, hull plates were ruptured, damaging her port engine and ultimately flooding her port machinery spaces, leading to a 30-degree list. She had to be towed clear by the destroyer Minegumo. The Japanese spent the night trying to make Admiral Yamamoto's dream of surface ships finishing off damaged enemy carriers come true. Admiral Abe's vanguard force had linked up with Admiral Kondo's advance force, and together they swept southward in an impressive armada, with the heavy cruisers in a Homeric-like line abreast, deploying floatplanes to scare up the enemy. But the American carriers were out of reach. The Enterprise was heading due south. At 12:30, the Japanese submarine I-17 spotted the carrier, followed shortly thereafter by the I-15, but neither boat could position itself for an attack, and the Enterprise would make her way to Pearl Harbor for repairs. The Japanese only found the destroyer Grayson, left behind to search for downed pilots. She prudently turned tail and fled. To avoid morning air attacks, so did the major Japanese forces. Except for one. Despite the loss of his putative air support, Admiral Tanaka turned around to head toward Guadalcanal. Though he had definitely been sighted, he had not been attacked. In the chaos surrounding the Japanese attack, Lieutenant Kellum's report of Tanaka's convoy had been overlooked on the Enterprise. Moreover, the Japanese thought they had at least set two American aircraft carriers on fire, and thus had at least driven off the American air power. But there was now a new player in the South Pacific. Admiral McCain's Catalina flying boats bravely patrolled in the night over the South Pacific. One, piloted by Ensign William C. Corbett, found seven ships, which were later determined to include one aircraft carrier. The report of one carrier, one light cruiser, and five destroyers, located 180 miles north of Guadalcanal, course 190 degrees true, speed 17 knots, reached Henderson Field at 4:30 a.m. During that same night, General Vandegrift's men had endured a shelling by Japanese destroyers Kagero, Isokaze, Kawakaze, Matsuki, and Yayoi, a bombardment that was far more annoying than damaging. The general also received a welcome reinforcement in the form of Lieutenant Caldwell's 11 Enterprise SBD Dauntlesses, who, having searched in vain for the enemy, were guided in for the night landing by flare-pots marking the runway. Despite their unfamiliarity with Guadalcanal, all the Dauntlesses landed without mishap. Vandegrift decided to take a whack at the approaching carrier with his little Cactus Air Force. He assembled a strike of 5 Marine and 3 Enterprise SBD Dauntlesses under Major Mangrum, escorted by 10 Marine Wildcats under Captain Smith, all of whom took off at 6 a.m. The Wildcats, lacking belly tanks, were forced by fuel issues to turn back, leaving their charges on their own. While heading back north of Malaita, the Marine fighters roughed up the Mavis of Warrant Officer Fujiwara Tomosaburo of the Yokohama Air Group. They thought they shot him down, but Fujiwara was able to get back to the Shortlands and run his badly damaged Kawanishi aground before it sank. Major Mangrum's unescorted bombers searched for the Japanese aircraft carriers who had pulled back and were nowhere to be found, but the Dauntlesses did stumble across the actual subjects of Ensign Corbett's sighting report, Admiral Tanaka's convoy, now with no air cover. By 8 a.m., they were 150 miles from Guadalcanal, planning to land their troops that night. Tanaka was issuing orders for the positioning of his ships for the landing when Mangrum's bombers spilled out of the clouds. The Japanese had been caught napping, in Admiral Tanaka's words. There was not even time to train the anti-aircraft guns up at the attackers. The Cactus Air Force pilots made shallow dives on the convoy. At 8:05, First Lieutenant Lawrence Baldinus planted a 1,000-pound bomb between the number 1 and 2 5.5-inch guns of Admiral Tanaka's trusted flagship Chinsu, an Allied nemesis since the beginning of the war. Shrapnel and flaming fragments were strewn everywhere, including the cruiser's bridge, where Tanaka himself was knocked unconscious. The blast killed 24, started a fire that forced the flooding of her forward magazines, and badly damaged the cruiser's bow. Lieutenant Colonel Mangrum was not done. 2 minutes later, Ensign Christian Fink of the Enterprise 6 plopped his own 1,000-pound bomb amidships on the auxiliary transport Kinryu Maru, carrying 800 members of the 5th Yokosuka Special Naval Landing Force. Mangrum himself got a near miss on the Boston Maru, carrying more troops of the Ichigi detachment. The Marine and Navy SPDs headed back to Henderson after a job well done. The stricken Kinryu Maru suffered a massive explosion as the stored ammunition began cooking off. She would not last much longer. Destroyers Mutsuki and Yayoi, who had hurried back from their largely ineffective bombardment of Henderson Field, and patrol boats 1 and 2 pulled alongside to take off the Special Naval Landing Force troops. Their mission of mercy was complicated when a flight of 3 B-17s under Captain Walter E. Chambers of the 11th Bombardment Group appeared overhead. The Yayoi and the patrol boats got underway for evasive maneuvers, but Mutsuki stayed motionless where she was. Her skipper, Lieutenant Commander Atano Kenji, wasn't all that concerned about B-17s or other American high-level bombers. Noting the B-17s were especially high, Atano said, "If they should hit us, we would be the first ship struck by horizontal bombers in this war." Commander Atano was mistaken, in more ways than one. At 10:15, the high-flying B-17s plopped at least one bomb in the Mutsuki's engineering spaces. The blast killed 41, injured 11, and left his command sinking. But Atano was right in one sense. His Mutsuki had the honor of becoming the first Japanese ship sunk by horizontal bombers. Atano was surprised, but unapologetic. Even the B-17s can make a hit once in a while. So now the Yayoi was left rescuing survivors from both the Kinryu Maru and the Mutsuki, who, while sinking, nevertheless managed to perform one last service for her emperor by sending a torpedo into the Kinryu Maru and putting the burning derelict under. Admiral Tanaka regained consciousness and, with his flagship too damaged to continue into what was obviously a combat zone, switched his flag to the destroyer Kagero. "My worst fears for this operation had been realized," Admiral Tanaka later wrote. His destroyers, carrying waterlogged troops, could not very well land those troops on Guadalcanal and expect them to be effective. The remaining troops were not enough to make a difference. He needed another way to get the troops to Guadalcanal. In the meantime, he had to withdraw, a decision affirmed by Combined Fleet and Eighth Fleet. In forcing the invasion convoy to turn back, this little airstrike by all 8 SPD Dauntlesses of the tiny Cactus Air Force had transformed what the Americans called the Battle of the Eastern Solomons from a tactical draw into an Allied victory. And in the process, it taught the Japanese a lesson that was costly, albeit perhaps not nearly as costly as it should have been, a lesson that would guide the Japanese strategy in the months ahead. As Admiral Yamamoto's Chief of Staff, Admiral Yugaki, put it, "It is apparent that landing on Guadalcanal by transport is hopeless unless the enemy planes are wiped out." Chapter 6. Pride Goeth. Few civilizations are believed to have an equal, let alone better, understanding of war than the Romans. Not perfect by any means. Notable failures include the battles of Teutoburg Forest and Adrianople, but the Romans had war down to a science. Yet at a basic level, the Roman idea of how to handle a war was very simple. You find the enemy and attack them. The Carthaginian general Hannibal grasped this philosophy better than any of Rome's enemies, in part because, it is now believed, he had spies in Rome. And Hannibal figured out a way to turn it against the Romans. He would let the Romans find him at a place of his choosing and attack at a time of his choosing. In 218 BC, Hannibal goaded the Romans into attacking him by charging across the Trebia River in December, when its swollen waters were barely above freezing, and he slaughtered them. The next year, Hannibal got the Romans to chase him into a narrow defile, with Lake Trasimenus on one side and on the other side, hills in which he had hidden his troops, and he slaughtered them again. In response, the Romans called for Quintus Fabius Maximus. Fabius had a new strategy. Instead of having his army attack Hannibal's, he would simply follow it, always camping in good defensive positions but sending out patrols to pick off parties Hannibal had sent out to forage for supplies, one by one, day after day. It was painful, arduous, and tedious, whittling down supplies and troops fighting under the Carthaginian banner. But it started to have an effect on Hannibal's army. It also had an effect on Rome's politics. It wasn't sexy enough. It wasn't fast enough. They wanted Hannibal out now. So Fabius was thrown out. The result was Cannae, the worst defeat in Roman history until that time. And Fabius was then put back in. Fabius' strategy for dealing with Hannibal became the norm for Rome's legions. Those who departed from it paid dearly, with their troops' lives and sometimes their own. But the Fabian strategy, as it was called, would largely hold until Hannibal left Italy. The Fabian strategy has become known by another name, War of Attrition, nibbling away at the enemy day after day after grueling day. War is often thought of as what we see in the movies, giant battles with thousands of troops, mass cavalry charges, swarms of bombers, fleets of thousands of ships. But not every day of war is a Midway, a Normandy, a Gettysburg, a Jutland, an Eastern Solomons. Not even most days. No, most days are snipers taking pot shots, a destroyer bombarding, a tussle between scout planes, a fight between patrols, a few planes on a bombing raid. After Eastern Solomons, both the Allies and the Japanese realized Guadalcanal was not going to be easy or quick, so they girded themselves as best they could for a long campaign. There would be no Coral Seas or Midways or Eastern Solomons for a little while. Now the war became Fabian. Not so much by choice as by necessity. Daily bombing raids that were too small to be decisive, running reinforcements in by the handful, bombardments by little destroyers, patrols clashing in the jungle, and float planes dropping flares and bombs at night. It was in the days after Eastern Solomons that the campaign for Guadalcanal started settling into its attrition phase. On August 26th, Base Air Force got into its routine of attacking Henderson Field almost every day. This day it was 17 G-4Ms escorted by 9 Zeros. Worn by New Georgia Coast Watcher Donald Kennedy at 11:24, Henderson Field got every flyable plane off the ground within 12 minutes. A dozen Wildcats moved to high altitude to offer a suitable reception for the Bettys, who arrived at 12:03. The Green Marine pilots, who had never intercepted Japanese twin-engine bombers before, marveled at the beautiful target presented by the impeccable Japanese V formation, three-fourths of a mile across. The rookie's shooting, however, did not match the beauty of the target. Captain Smith later complained, "They wanted to shoot them all down. They did a lot of general shooting and didn't get any bombers at all." Not quite. Base Air Force acknowledged two Bettys did not return, while two more force-landed, which usually meant crash-landed. Three Zeros were write-offs as well, including one piloted by the Tainan Air Group's talented fighter leader, Lieutenant J.G. Sasai Junichi. All the remainder of the bombers were damaged to some degree. For this cost, the Japanese dropped some 50 bombs, which set off a fuel dump with 2,000 gallons of gasoline, which in turn detonated two 1,000-pound bombs. They shot down one Wildcat with its pilot, Second Lieutenant Roy A. Corey. This became the standard practice for Base Air Force whenever the weather would allow for passage down what Japanese aviators called the Guadal Highway, Garoru Gaito. A typical air attack would consist of a mixture of 18 or 27 Mitsubishi G4M Type 1 bombers from all the air groups available at Rabaul, usually the Kisarazu and Misawa air groups of the 6th Air Attack Force, under Vice Admiral Yamagata Seigo. The 4th Air Group, so shredded in the initial air attacks against the Guadalcanal landings on August 7th and 8th, was now restricted to reconnaissance. Starting to trickle in were some bombers from the famous Kanoya Air Group of the 21st Air Flotilla, now designated 1st Air Attack Force, the killers of the Prince of Wales and Repulse. But the Kanoya would find that things had changed since those early days. For starters, now they needed fighter protection. Escort was usually provided by the Zeros of the famous Tainan Air Group from the 5th Air Attack Force. They would soon be augmented by fighters from the 6th Air Attack Force's 6th Air Group, who were also about to start trickling in. There would be 12 or 18 Zeros, usually deployed in two groups behind and to either side of the bomber formation. The bomber formation might be best described as a V of Vs of Vs, a wide, flat V formed by 9 plane divisions, each in a V of its own, formed by its 3 plane sections, each of which also formed a V. Typically, each bomber would be loaded with a 551-pound high-explosive bomb and 6 132-pound anti-personnel bombs, or 10 132-pound anti-personnel bombs, which the Allies called daisy cutters. In the Japanese Naval Air Force, this was fairly standard. Too standard for a campaign that was becoming anything but. Indeed, standard practice for the Sea Eagles was to take off on or after sunrise and return no later than sunset to avoid the dangers of operating aircraft in the dark and around mountains. With a 4-hour flight to Guadalcanal, that left a window of only, at its widest, perhaps 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. for them to be over the target. The Americans figured out the window when the Japanese could arrive and dubbed it Tojo time. That the Americans had figured out the scheduling was only part of the issue for the Japanese. There was also that Ferdinand network of coast watchers in the Solomons. Jack Reed and Paul Mason on Bougainville would see the Japanese strike just after takeoff and radio the first warnings. Donald Kennedy on New Georgia would see the strike approximately 45 minutes from Guadalcanal and radio a final warning. Between the obvious strike window and the warning from the coast watchers, it was extremely difficult for the Japanese bombers to catch the American aircraft on the ground. The American bombers would have been sent east to ride out the attack, while the fighters would be positioning themselves to intercept. The Japanese were aware of the coast watchers, but repeated searches and sweeps failed to make much more than a dent in Ferdinand, thanks in large part to the hostility of the native Melanesians that Japanese behavior had incurred. And there were some handicaps that the Japanese Naval Air Force had inflicted on itself. For all the Japanese expertise in optics, especially long-range and night vision, their bombsight did not live up to their reputation. Moreover, compared to their American adversaries, the Japanese had tiny bombs, their heaviest being 551 pounds. The heaviest American bomb was 2,000 pounds. Similarly, the payload for the Mitsubishi G4M Type 1 land attack plane was 2,200 pounds. Part of the reason for this relatively small payload was that the G4M was designed to attack targets at sea, often with torpedoes. Strictly speaking, there was no American direct counterpart to the Betty. The closest was the Martin B-26 Marauder, which could attack targets at sea with a torpedo slung under its belly. But even the Marauder's early version could carry a payload of 3,000 pounds, the same as the B-25 Mitchell. Both were medium bombers like the Betty. The Japanese had no heavy bomber, no counterpart to the B-17 Flying Fortress or B-24 Liberator. There was also the issue of pilot protection. The Japanese Naval Air Force had made a conscious decision to emphasize speed and maneuverability in its aircraft over an armored cockpit, shatterproof glass, or self-sealing fuel tanks, all of which added weight to the aircraft. It was an expression of confidence in the pilot, but it also meant that the pilot had better be perfect, or he would soon be dead. And no pilot is perfect. Sakai Saburo's shock at the ability of the Grumman F-4F Wildcat to take some 10 minutes of punishment and keep flying is indicative of the difference. A Zero can't take 2 seconds fire from a Grumman, explained 1st Marine Air Wing Assistant Operations Officer Major Joseph N. Renner, and a Grumman can take sometimes as high as 15 minutes fire from a Zero. The Type 1 bomber was, if anything, even worse. Its nicknames included Type 1 Lighter and Flying Cigar for its propensity to catch fire very easily. The Cactus Air Force's John Smith developed tactics for a pilot to position himself for the easiest possible shot at the Betty's fuel tanks. That was one reason the G-4Ms needed fighter protection, but close escort by fighters was almost impossible thanks to another conscious decision, taking the radios out of all but a few of their Zeros. They found the radios too unreliable and too short-range to be effective, and it saved almost 40 pounds of weight. But it meant that fighter pilots could communicate with each other in flight only with hand signals or waggling wings, not the speediest, most efficient, or most effective forms of communication in combat. Finally, there was the target environment, which circles back to the issue of distance. The Lunga airfield was held by Americans and defended by Americans. An American aircraft damaged in combat was thus near a base to which it could return. An American aircraft shot down left the pilot both near a base and in an area with friendly native Melanesians. Damaged Japanese aircraft would have to make, as Sakai Saburo did, the long haul back up the Guadal Highway, 560 nautical miles to Rabaul and more than 400 to the emergency strip at Buka. The Shortland base complex, in which was located Buin, where Admiral Tsukahara had ordered construction of a new airstrip, was more than 300 miles away. The upshot was that an American pilot shot down stood a good chance of surviving, being recovered, and returning to duty. A Japanese pilot shot down was likely never to return to duty. It added up to serious aerial losses for the Japanese. By August 26, the base Air Force was down to 29 serviceable bombers and 19 Zeros, with which they had to attack Guadalcanal and New Guinea. The 6th Air Attack Force was still arriving in a piecemeal fashion, so to tie them over, base Air Force needed a temporary attachment of 30 Zeros from the Shokaku and Zuikaku, all of which staged in Dubuka on August 28th. But these low numbers would not stay low. The Japanese planned a massive reinforcement effort so that by September 20th, base Air Force would have 93 Zeros with long-range capability, 81 G-4M bombers, 6 Type 99 dive bombers, 4 reconnaissance planes, and 14 flying boats. Also on August 28th, Admiral Mikawa's 8th Fleet reconfigured its own contribution to Japanese air power by putting all its seaplanes and their parent tenders into one organization that was given the title of Our Area Air Force. This new organization, under newly promoted Rear Admiral Jojima Takatsugu of the 11th Seaplane Tender Division, would use its seaplane tenders Chitose Kamikawa Maru, Sanyo Maru, and Sanuki Maru to operate float planes all over the R area. Once he figured out where exactly the R area was, Admiral Jojima assembled his forces in Shortland. His most powerful units would be the veterans Kamikawa Maru and Chitose. The Kamikawa Maru had about a dozen of those float Zeros, the Nakajima A6M2N Type 2. The Chitose had maybe 16 of those Type 0 observation seaplanes. These should not be confused with the Type 0 reconnaissance seaplane, of which the Chitose had 7. Admiral Jojima would anchor his Chitose in Shortland Harbor to serve as his headquarters while rotating his other tenders through Santa Isabel's Rakata Bay, thus providing one meaning for our area and placing his forces only 135 miles north of Henderson Field. His seaplanes would dance in and out of the bay, as would his seaplane tenders, to avoid the inevitable Allied airstrikes. These started almost immediately, as B-17s were taking an interest in the area. On September 1st, they had attacked the seaplane tender Akitsushima and the old destroyer Akikaze off Buka, doing trifling damage to the former. The next day, the Sanyo Mayuru packed much of its base personnel aboard Patrol Boat 35 and departed Shortland, giving the staff all the luxury and comfort the old converted destroyer Tsutsa could offer, until 11 a.m. or so, when a B-17 of the 11th Bombardment Group showed up, released a stick of bombs, and left the demoted destroyer dead in the water. At some point, the patrol boat sank, taking her skipper, Reserve Lieutenant Kumai Zentaro, and 92 others with her, with 52 survivors. But the Japanese just sent another patrol boat and opened the base on September 5th. From the Rakata Bay area, the R Area Air Force would be a persistent thorn in the Marine side, especially with its rather rude habit of sending solitary float planes to loudly hang out over Lunga at night, dropping flares and the occasional bomb, and keeping the Marines awake. This annoyance would earn from the Marines the nickname Louis the Louse. The R Area Air Force had solved issues of distance by moving closer. Base Air Force could not, at least not until the Buin airfield was complete. And that distance also posed issues of climate. The Solomons have volatile weather, and a storm brewing up over, say, New Georgia could prevent the Japanese from attacking Guadalcanal, but allow American air operations to continue unimpeded. So could Rabaul's Tovervor and Vulcan volcanoes, which nibbled away at aircraft and caused maintenance problems. Weather was an issue on August 27th and 28th, as airstrikes by base Air Force were forced to return to base by bad weather. The weather did not keep a reinforcement, 14 new P-400s, the remainder of the 67th Fighter Squadron, from reaching Henderson Field. But there was a little ground combat as General Vandegrift decided to try another sortie against the Matanico with his 1st Battalion of the 5th Marine Regiment. The battalion was inexperienced, with a commander, Lieutenant Colonel William E. Maxwell, who tried to make up for the greenness with an insistence on strict adherence to orders and a ruthless response to perceived mistakes. Just as there had been with King Bode on the Chicago, the effect was hesitation and indecisiveness. The sortie landed west of Kokumbona, but on top of the hesitation and indecisiveness came vague orders, problematic terrain, and a lack of intelligence on Captain Monzen and what was left of his construction laborers and Special Naval Landing Force troops. The result was paralysis, a stunted, indecisive advance, and ultimately the removal of Colonel Maxwell. Not that the Japanese could take advantage. As he was returning to the Shortlands on August 26th after the Cactus Air Force successfully turned back his reinforcement convoy, Admiral Tanaka received an order from Admiral Tsukahara directing him to transport the remaining 300-odd troops to Guadalcanal in fast warships on the night of August 27th. Tanaka wondered just how much thought had been put into this order, but orders were still orders. He dutifully directed the following. Umikaze, Yamakaze, and Isokaze will take the 390 troops now loaded in the transport, together with 4 rapid-fire guns and provisions for 1,300 troops, and leave Shortland for Guadalcanal at 0500 hours under Commander Desrone 24, the 24th Destroyer Division. At 2100, they will arrive at Cape Taivu to land troops and supplies. During the night, they will return from Guadalcanal. It seems simple enough. As soon as Admiral Tanaka arrived in Shortland, he discussed the situation with the Army commander. They spent the entire sleepless night transferring troops, provisions, and munitions to 3 destroyers. Early next morning, the 3 destroyers were headed to Guadalcanal, led by the commander of the 24th Destroyer Division, Captain Murakami Yonosuke. After a few hours, Admiral Tanaka received a new order from Admiral Mikawa of the 8th Fleet, directing him to land the troops on Guadalcanal 24 hours later, on August 28th. A flabbergasted Tanaka replied that the destroyers transporting the troops had already left. Mikawa came back with, "Recall destroyers at once. Am sending Desdiv 20, 20th Destroyer Division, to Shortland, where it will be under Comdesron 2, 2nd Destroyer Flotilla." It was the third time Tanaka had received conflicting orders from his immediate superior and his immediate superior's superior. This was despite the fact that their headquarters were within walking distance of each other in Rabaul. He acidly commented, "It was inconceivable that no liaison existed between the headquarters of 11th Air Fleet, Base Air Force, and 8th Fleet, since both were located at Rabaul, and yet such seemed to be the case. I had again received contradictory and conflicting orders from the area commander and my immediate superior, and was at a loss as to what to do. If such circumstances continue, I thought, how can we possibly win a battle? It occurred to me again that this operation gave no evidence of careful, deliberate study. Everything seemed to be completely haphazard. But conflicting orders were still orders, and Admiral Tanaka had to have the destroyers he so recently sent away come back. Tanaka was caught in the middle of a power struggle with General Kawaguchi Kiyotake of the Army's 35th Brigade. Kawaguchi had arrived at Truk on August 23rd and was presented with orders from 17th Army that his troops were to head to Guadalcanal immediately on transports. To Kawaguchi, however, orders were more what you'd call guidelines than actual directives. Certainly, he had no intention of stepping aboard slow, fat transports vulnerable to American air power from Guadalcanal, nor would he go by fast, cramped destroyer. No, Kawaguchi preferred barges. A typical barge, the Daihatsu Army Type A, was a 50-foot open creature with, when fully loaded, a top speed of 7 knots. It could carry some 70 men, 10 tons of cargo, or even one light tank. Kawaguchi's troops had advanced up to 500 miles by barge during their successful campaign in Borneo. How much of the success of this tactic was due to his opponents in Borneo, the colonial Dutch and later Abdicom, having almost no air power, does not seem to have crossed the general's mind. He would land at Shortland, move to Gizo off New Georgia in the Middle Solomons, and take barges from island to island every night down the rest of the Solomons to Guadalcanal. It would be slow, but his troops would get there, eventually. The general left Truk on August 24th, the day of the carrier battle of the Eastern Solomons. The following day, Admiral Tanaka's convoy was turned back by the Cactus Air Force with heavy losses. So the 17th Army sent General Kawaguchi new orders. Some 600 of his men were to be rushed to Guadalcanal aboard 4 destroyers. The rest of the brigade would go to Rabaul with him, where they arrived 4 days later. Much of August 26th was spent transferring the 2nd Battalion of the 124th Infantry Regiment to the destroyers Asagiri, Amagiri, Yugiri, and Shirakumo, the 4 ships of the 20th Destroyer Division under Captain Yamada Yuji. This was why they were being added to Admiral Tanaka's command and his next high-speed destroyer convoy to land the night of August 28th. Tanaka issued orders to this effect to Captain Murakami. One slight catch. Because of fuel issues, Captain Yamada's destroyers could not stop at Shortland. Instead, they would hang east of the Solomons, operating independently of Captain Murakami's destroyers, and dash in on the night of August 28th. This further served to increase my pessimism about the success of the landing operation, Tanaka later wrote. There was one other slight catch. Around 5 p.m. on August 28th, a pair of radioless Dauntlesses, piloted by 1st Lieutenant Danny Iverson and 2nd Lieutenant Hank Heiss, found the 4 destroyers loitering off Santa Isabel, 60 miles north of Savo Island. Iverson could not get into attack position, but Heiss dove on one of the destroyers and missed. He raced back to Henderson Field and taxied right up to the pagoda to report the contact. Not even a half hour later, Lieutenant Colonel Mangrum led 11 Dauntlesses into the air looking for this new prey. They found Captain Yamada's little flotilla at 6:05, just before sunset. The Navy Dauntlesses went after the Shirakumo and Asagiri. The Enterprise's Lieutenant Caldwell planted a 1,000-pound bomb on the quarterdeck of the Shirakumo, flooding an engine room and leaving her dead in the water. Ensign Fink, rapidly acquiring a reputation of never miss 'em, dropped his directly on the torpedo tubes of the Asagiri. The bomb's detonation set off the torpedoes, resulting in a massive, spectacular explosion that blew the Asagiri in two. The Marine SPDs went after the other 2 destroyers. One sent a 1,000-pound bomb into the Yugiri's bridge, killing Captain Yamada and 31 others, and injuring 40. A strafing run on the lone undamaged destroyer Amagiri resulted in the death of Marine Lieutenant Oliver Mitchell and his gunner Private P.O. Shackman by anti-aircraft fire. The Amagiri went on to have a busy evening. She first moved to pick up survivors from her sister Asagiri, rescuing 135 officers and crew and 83 soldiers, leaving 122 dead crew and troops. Then, accompanied by the battered Yugiri, the destroyer dragged the powerless carcass of the Shirakumo, who despite having no power suffered only 2 wounded, towards the Shortlands. Admiral Tanaka was dismayed, but not surprised. At 8:40 p.m., Tanaka sent a signal to the effect of, "This attack made it more obvious than ever what sheer recklessness it was to attempt a landing operation against strong resistance without preliminary neutralization of enemy air power. If the present operation plan for Guadalcanal was not altered, we were certain to suffer further humiliating and fruitless casualties."